Pets are such a wonderful part of life. Whether they cheer us up with their unconditional love or make us laugh with their antics, life just wouldn't be the same without them for a lot of us. And we're lucky that Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine takes time each month to spend with us to give us advice on keeping our pets happy and healthy. Sandy, it's always great to have you back.
It is nice to be here.
And as usual, we have lots to talk about. So let's actually start about with some of the extreme weather that a lot of the state has endured in the last few weeks. You know, even though right now a lot of us are enjoying a bit of a respite, it's amazing how cool 88 can feel after 100 plus. You think, ooh, you almost need a jacket. Yeah. There's probably more hot weather in store for us. What are some things to keep in mind with pets and health and heat?
Yeah, well, you know, people that listen know that I have two well-loved English bulldogs, and sometimes I really question whether they have a brain or not. When it was over 100 degrees, I walked in, house is air conditioned, but we have a dog door going out to the backyard. There, both dogs are laying on our, we have paver type, you know, mm-hmm. the bricks patio, out there just panting like crazy next to their dog pool. But no, okay. So I had to like bring them in and close the dog door because they were too dumb to come inside.
The only way
dogs can cool themselves is through panting and sweating through their feet. Mm. And so, you know, you've got a bulldog that has that pushed in face. They really pant inefficiently. So we have the pool and everything for them. So you have to sometimes be your pet's brains, you know, walk them early in the morning. They may want to still play in that hot weather, but bring them inside. You know, if you see really big, wide, open mouth breathing, the gums are looking brick red, you know, the pupils dilated and the dog is like panicking like that, get them in, cool them down, wet towels over them or whatever, and then call the veterinarian. You may be able to, you know, if you want to take their temperature, by all means, I think every pet owner should know how to do that. And if it's, you know, 103 and above is considered having a fever. And it's not uncommon if they've been outside even just for a short period of time to have their temperature be up like that. But if it's over 104, you know, and up, then definitely mm-hmm. call your veterinarian and get some advice.
And like people are either young dogs or older dogs more susceptible?
Yes, definitely. You know, and part of it, especially with older dogs, is a lot of them have heart disease or respiratory problems. And yeah. And so, you know, again, just, you know, be smart for your pet and, you know, less activity, you know, nighttime, even in the nighttime, last week, it was still too mm-hmm. humid even at night to be able to be outside and play.
Right.
But I got to experience extreme weather last month on Father's Day. I'm lucky to be here mm-hmm. alive. Survived.
We're happy you are.
Yes. Survived a tornado with my two dogs. We spend a lot of time at a cabin on a lake called Big Stone Lake, which is right on the border of South Dakota and Minnesota. They've dammed up a river and turned it into this beautiful lake. And we were there actually at the next door neighbors that have a full basement, the cabin we stay in, concrete slab. And I was in the cabin feeding the dogs their dinner. Mark came running over saying, quick, there's a tornado coming from across the lake. Of course, we don't have a radio or anything going. I at least knew where the leashes were and grabbed them and got these two bowling balls of dogs moving. We got out the door just when the front of the cabin disappeared and the fridge and stove blew out the door behind us. We had just stepped away from that area and a 4-foot wide cottonwood tree came down on the other side. I'm in bare feet. Dogs are, you know, they're panicking, but we made it out alive. And I had one scratch on my foot because I was in bare feet walking through branches and broken glass and down power lines. But we all made it out. So moral of the story is always have a plan. Okay,
right.
Which means knowing where the leashes are, having your pets microchipped, because if I wasn't there and, you know, they happened to get loose and go running.
And like you said, they were panicking like everybody else.
They were panicking. Yes. Yeah. Right, you know, so very, very important to have that, you know, a plan ready. And now I know that it can hit any time.
And also, if you hadn't been able to put your hands on the leashes right away, even 10 more seconds of looking for them could have been tragic for you and the dogs.
We literally, within 1 second or two, we not would have made it out.
Wow. So, well, glad you're here to tell the tale.
Yes.
And going back to the heat, I've seen a few things around that even, you know, in hot weather, asphalt can be really dangerous.
It can. We had a dog in the other day with burned feet. And one thing that we forget about, too, is I call it scalding hose syndrome, where, you know, you've got the hose on and it's been laying out in the yard. That water is boiling mm-hmm. hot in there. And you turn it on. If it's like my dogs, they go running over to attack the water. if they were there when that hot water was coming out, they would have gotten burned. So be really careful about that.
So
as
maybe
well.
When you start the hose, do it straight down at the
straight
ground.
Straight down. Don't let them go near it until the water cools off, and then you can go ahead and let them play in it.
So we're talking about dogs that are obviously spending some of their time outside. What about things for cats? Even, you know, even if they're staying indoors.
Yeah, cats are a little smarter. They just kind of chill and lay down.
Although they will still often find that one hot spot on the floor where the sun's coming in.
Yeah, they may. But at least they're in air conditioning, right. Hopefully. But I rarely ever see problems with cats being outdoors and exercising too much.
Right.
They just
they self-regulate a
yes,
little bit.
They do. Yeah.
And any other general heat-related things we should keep in mind?
Well, you know, traveling in the car. I actually, with not having a cabin to go to now, we just bought an RV. So we have a small RV, so our dogs can travel in style, and we checked out, and the air conditioning works, and everything's fine. But even with that, you know, you don't want to be leaving pets even for just a few seconds in the car. In this type of weather, it can overheat very, very
much
quickly.
Better to leave them at home.
Leave them at home, yeah. Yep.
We're talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, who will be back tomorrow. He is back from the wonderful Wisconsin Public Radio garden tour of London and Southeast England. Had a great time, and there are some brand new photos from their last day or so up on our Facebook page that you can check out. Wonderful gardens, and it looks like everybody's having a great time. That's the Larry Mueller Show, M-E-I-L-L-E-R, on Facebook, and you do not need to be a member to be able to see those. And you can join the conversation with Sandy by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Amanda Magnus, our on-air producer today. And Sandy, we have Anne in Harpers Spring, Michigan on the line. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Thank you. It's Harbor Springs.
Oh, okay. Harbor Springs.
Yes. I have a cat who's 5 years old. She's very well behaved and very well housebroken, but she has there's a rug that she likes to play with the corner of this rug, and on occasion, for some reason, she will defecate in the corner of this rug. Hmm. And I'll wake up and find it there, and so I'll clean it up, and I cleaned it up with carpet cleaner to get rid of the smell and everything. And even before I go to bed, I clean the litter box to make sure it's really clean before, you know, I go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
The other morning, I woke up, and she had done it again.
Well, I think one of the things that you said is you clean the litter box, okay? And that makes me think that you might only have one. And
yes, one cat.
Yeah, but the rule of thumb is a litter box for every cat plus one. The reason is many cats like to urinate in one place and defecate in another. And so we really need to go back and look at the litter box management. Before you do that, I mean, yes, definitely we'll talk about that, but make sure that you have your cat checked by your veterinarian. Sometimes when we have cats that are defecating out of the box, there may be a medical cause for it. Sometimes for older cats, the posture that they have to be in, if they're arthritic, it may bother them, and so they may pick a spot where they get better footing. For some cats, it may be their anal glands or anal sacs on either side of the rectum are full, and they associate the litter box with discomfort. We've had some cats that have had inflammatory bowel disease that now associate, boy, it hurts when I go to the bathroom in the litter box, so I'm going to go elsewhere. And they develop this superstitious-like behavior. So have your cat checked to make sure that there isn't a medical problem for it. But while you're calling and getting that appointment set up, other things that you can do at home, a litter box in at least two places in your home. We like to have them separated out too. I always equate having two litter boxes side by side with having you build your dream home and putting both toilets in the same bathroom. Doesn't serve the family a lot of good. So separate places in the house, preferably one on every floor. If she has picked that particular corner, that would be the ideal spot to put a litter box for her. Maybe not for you, but initially start with it there, and then you can very slowly, inch by inch, move it to a more suitable spot. Preferably a spot where she has good escape potential. She's not going to feel trapped. We don't like to have it next to a major appliance like a furnace or a washing machine or anything like that, because that may scare them. covered boxes are usually not accepted by cats. Some cats will tolerate them. Some cats love them. But many cats don't like using a covered box. And after just spending a weekend at Summerfest and seeing the lineups for the bathrooms and knowing that there's porta potties out there, I chose to stand in line for a flush toilet rather than using a porta potty. That's what a covered box is like, okay? It harbors odors. Very difficult for most cats to move around in.
Yeah.
Then also look at the size of the litter box you're using. Many of the commercially available litter boxes for cats are just not suitable for your average cat. They're too small. Litter box should be about 1.5 times the length of the cat from head to rump. So we've got, you know, measure your cat. And so for my cats, which are quite large, I end up buying plastic storage bins and throw the lids away and use those. And they work very well for litter boxes, and they're much less expensive. I also find that those cement mixing trays you can get at home improvement stores that cost $3 or $4 work great. They're big enough that you can use as well. And then making sure you're using a soft, scoopable, sandy litter, preferably unscented. But if you do need to use an odor control, this research has shown that cats seem to like the carbon-based odor control over things like baking soda. So using some one of those types of litters, and so do a label, you know, some label searching, and keep it clean like you are, and hopefully that will get your cat under control.
Well, thanks for all your help.
Yeah.
Sure. Good luck with that. And I know that can be stressful.
It is stressful for us. And then we get mad and we may yell at the cat. We take the cat over and we rub their nose in it or whatever. And that just creates a cat that's like, I don't want to be near my owner. I don't like the litter box because every time I am in, you know, my owner gets upset, they carry me over and plunk me in the litter box and yell at me. And now the litter box is this evil spot.
It's like a punishment.
It is. So, we have to really watch what we do with our kitties.
Great. Thanks for that call. And actually, that leads into something that's been in the news recently. There have been some links drawn between toxoplasmosis, which is a cat fecal parasite, that there may be some kind of connection, they're not sure what it is, with an increased suicide risk for women. And people are, and that's always been a concern, toxoplasmosis for pregnant women.
Right.
But now people are saying, are we at risk just having cats? And,
you
know, so we wanted to talk about that from a less emotional
position. From a veterinarian's point of view. Well, I can tell you when I was pregnant with my daughter, this was a number of years ago, I had a test done. Most pregnant women end up getting tested for toxoplasmosis, and I came back negative. You want to be positive if you can, because that makes it, you don't have to worry during your pregnancy then that you are going to get newly infected.
So positive would mean that you had
been exposed in the past, you know. And I was negative. And I was like, well, that's interesting. Well, I was told by my OBGYN, this was again 20 years ago, that I may not want to work as a veterinarian. And I'm like, what? You know, and so that made me start to realize that the misinformation that's out there for the general public on this particular parasite is just rampant. And so, first of all, it is a parasite that only cats can shed, okay? So the cats are the only species that can actually shed it in their stool. It's microscopic. You don't see it. You can pick it up on a stool check. But cats will only shed it for about 2 weeks in their life, period. And then they develop gut immunity and will not likely ever shed it again. And so the cats that we see at risk of shedding this are usually kittens, or a new cat that's just been adopted that's been allowed to go out and go hunting or anything like that, because cats will pick it up from eating infected meat or grooming infected soil off of their feet. So a couple of weeks in their life. So your 15-year-old strictly indoor cat that's on commercial cat food is not at risk. You would have, you know, really virtually no risk of you picking it up from your cat. It also takes 3 to 5 days for it to become infective once it's in the litter box. So if you are following the rules of litter box management and scooping daily, again, you pretty much have eliminated any chance because that stage in that first couple of days is not infective for us. So scoop every day if you can.
And obviously, which hopefully everyone's doing, wash your hands after doing this.
Right. How do humans get it then? If you don't have a cat, why do some people get it? Well, this is an organism that once it is passed by a cat outside, so you've got stray cats that are defecating in your garden or whatever, the organism will stay in the soil forever. I mean, it really, nothing kills it. And so it'll survive forever. And so how do we get it? Gardening without gloves. not washing our vegetables thoroughly, eating undercooked meat. Okay, so making sure that, I think I read someplace that about a third of the pork in the United States is positive for toxoplasmosis. So cook your pork well. A lot of like unpasteurized dairy products, especially goat products, seem to be a big issue too. I don't know why, but making sure that it's handled correctly, that it's processed correctly. And again, you're going to really decrease your risk. So I tell anybody, whether it be somebody that's immunocompromised, that's on chemotherapy, or someone that has HIV or anything like that, or a pregnant woman that may be negative for toxo, meaning they haven't been exposed, wash your vegetables, garden with gloves, cook your meat well, scoop the litter box out daily. Good thing for somebody else in the family right. to be able to do. And you're pretty well going to be fairly risk-free.
Good. So
don't get rid of your kittens.
Yeah, don't get rid of your kittens or cats. And and they're still trying to figure out
the link.
I was reading a Scientific American article, and they actually said that one of the things they have to guard against is that immediately people are thinking, oh, toxoplasmosis may cause
right.
the suicide risk. They're looking at people that are more prone to suicide who may be more susceptible to toxoplasmosis.
Right.
So it could be actually the reverse.
You got it.
So
right.
so there's a lot more research to be done, it sounds like. So we just wanted to let people know.
Maybe all those people are gardening without gloves
there
or something
go.
Like that.
There
and picking it up. Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking with Dr. Sandy Sajak of the UW Veterinary School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Dr. Sandy Sajak of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine here to share her knowledge and expertise about keeping our pets happy and healthy. And Connie in Portage is a fellow English Bulldog owner, so let's go there. Hi, Connie.
Hi. Sandy, I just wanted to thank you. Because we've had three English Bulldogs. We have one left, Sophie.
Uh-huh.
And she's in air conditioning all the time. And every time she goes outside, she lays in the sun and pants. And I just wanted to thank you, Mike. Now I know she's not abnormal.
Yeah. Well, maybe all three of our dogs are just, suffering from being a bulldog and not having the, be
common
the smartest
sense.
Breed around, but
they're so cute though.
Well, they are, but I think that's what I mean by being the brains for your dog. We had a dog that actually died from being, this was several years ago at the vet school, the owner was riding his horse and his dog likes to run along beside him, and it was a very hot day, probably not good for the horse either, but because the dog wanted to keep running, he just figured, okay, the dog isn't tired, and the dog ended up developing hyperthermia and died. So it can happen. And so that's where, we really have to pay attention to those little subtle cues that our dogs are giving us. So just realize, hey, if I'm hot, you must be hot. So let's get you indoors.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Connie. Thanks for sharing that. And Shirley in Prentice has a question. Hi, Shirley.
Thank you. I'm very happy that you survived that storm.
Thank you.
Sandy. Yeah, that was a scary story.
I have a question. I'm very suspicious of the way my friend worms his cats and himself each day with diatomaceous earth. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
Yes, I have. It doesn't work. So,
it does not work, you say?
It does not work. It's one of those things that's kind of a folk remedy type thing that that is very ineffective. Is it going to be causing any harm? I mean, I know like diatomaceous earth is used for swimming pool filters and a number of things, and it can bind and trap material. But I would not be giving it to his cat. If he wants to treat himself, by all means, it's his health. But look out for those little kitties, and I would not be using it. There are other safe, effective deworming agents on the market. And I always recommend that people use, there's a wonderful website if you've got an interest in parasites that's called, it's a national organization called the Companion Animal Parasite Association, and it's a council. It's CAPC.org, Companion Animal Parasite Council.org. And there they have stuff that, you can read very scientific articles, see lots of pictures. They talk about dewormers, all kinds of wonderful things, as well as a site for pet owners to go to as well, which is not quite as descriptive, but will also give some good information. So I would recommend that he go to that site and perhaps look up whether this is an effective thing or not.
Thank you. He also cooks food for his animals. He is suspicious of anything canned. He looks at all the ingredients. I've told him that taurine, I guess it's called, must be fed to cats, and it is in cat food bought. But with his cats not getting that, that's not so good either.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the problem, is making sure that diet is well balanced. I mean, people go about it with good intentions, but cats are very unique critters that have their own specific needs, and taurine is an amino acid that they are unable to manufacture, but they need high levels of it, and it is found in meat, but an all-meat diet would be totally inappropriate for a cat because they need minerals and some carbohydrates, you know, at lower levels, just for healthy gut function and all kinds of things like that. And what I've seen is people will start with a specific diet that is, you know, laid out for them, and then you start getting some ingredients shift. To give you an example, they may start out with ground round and then switch to ground beef, and just the difference in that will cause the protein
percentage.
And the fat percentage or whatever, it's not the same. So you have to be really, really careful when if you're wanting to do this. And the convenience of commercial diets is definitely there, and it also, you know, there's a lot of science behind it, especially if you go with the national companies that have gone through AFCO feeding trials, not just to meet AFCO standards, that stands for American Association of Feed Control Officials, but the foods that have actually gone through feeding trials, you know that you're going to be getting something that's well balanced.
Great, thanks for that call, Shirley. And I know diatomaceous earth has come up several times. What is the diatomaceous part of diatomaceous earth?
I don't know. I'm sorry. I wish I did, but I just know that it is used for like filtering toxins and things out, and that's why they use it in swimming pool filters because it globs.
So maybe it has
stuff
a high carbon.
Stuff. Yeah, something in
we'll
there.
We'll ask Amanda if she can look up diatomaceous earth and see what that might be. Thanks for that call, Shirley. Teresa in Oshkosh is next. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. My question is about my Springer Spaniel who has this dandruff problem, and sometimes his skin gets so bad that it's like waxy. And my dog beauty person said that I could use dandruff shampoo when it got really bad, like especially on the ears. Not all the time, she said, but I didn't think you could use people's shampoo at all with dogs.
Well, you can, but I'd be really careful about using some of the medicated shampoos for us. Remember, dogs have a different skin chemistry than we do, and I would be concerned if you're getting that much flaking, like on the ears and things, that your dog may have a dermatologic problem such as primary seborrhea. And in those cases, working with your veterinarian or a veterinary dermatologist, they would probably be able to give you, shampoos or suggestions for things that will help keep that flaking and things at bay. I know that we've got, I have actually a friend with a German Shepherd that has been diagnosed with primary seborrhea and gets these huge flakes and it gets, skin will get really irritated because it is so flaky, more prone to bacterial infections. And she needs to bathe her dog a couple of times a week and use a anti-seborrheic shampoo for dogs. And it seems to be keeping everything under control. So, but I'd be really hesitant about using human stuff. So, we put it on our head. We're not putting it all over our body and rinse, we rinse thoroughly. I'm not sure if you're going to be able to do that with your dog, especially in the head area. So get that looked into. And if your veterinarian is uncomfortable with dealing with skin issues, there is a specialty in the veterinary world that is dermatology, and we are lucky enough in the Madison area to have our two board certified dermatologists, as well as their very excellent clinician, their resident here, that would be more than willing to help you with your pet.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Great. Thanks so much for that call, Teresa. And Amanda got right on the research there. And we have diatomaceous earth is a naturally occurring soft
silicious
sedimentary rock that is easily crumbled into a into a fine white to off-white powder. Mm-hmm. It contains fossilized remains of diatoms, a type of hard-shelled algae, and it gives a lot of uses, but one of the most interesting ones, it's a stabilizing compound for dynamite.
There we go. Well, I know that in the past, it has been used for controlling fleas in the environment. They like statically charge it, and you have this stuff beaten into your carpet, but because it has a high silica, the pets right down on that carpet area can develop silicosis by inhaling it or ingesting it. So again, the safety issue, it's just, don't be giving it orally to your pet.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for that research, Amanda. And we have had a couple of emails and a Facebook question. On Facebook, Libby asked, does Dr. Sandy have any advice about bringing a new baby into a two-dog household? I'm due in September, and my husband and I have two mostly well-behaved German Shepherds.
It's really good to be thinking about it right now. Having your dogs trained to be on a sit stay or a down stay, because you're going to be walking around with a baby and the last thing you need is a dog jumping up at you or, grabbing at your sleeve or doing anything, especially if you've got a baby wrapped in a blanket. So look at your dog's behavior right now and really assess, are they behaving like I want them to, that they'll lay down and so on. The things that I would be looking into would be, maybe considering bringing in a baby doll and a blanket and be sitting and holding on to that, making sure the dog doesn't think it's a toy. So you can practice with that. People always recommend bringing home something that smells like the infant once they're, born in the hospital. Mm. But that would be, right now you don't have a baby to do that with. And I'd also be looking at how well your dog gets along with friends' children and babies. And if they've never been exposed to young children, no time like the present to get them socialized. Obviously, you'd have to have them well controlled and the child well controlled, but work on that. There is a book, and I'm drawing a blank on the name of it, but I remember the author's name. His name is Brian Kilcommons, and I think it's like Introducing Your Dog to Your New Baby. This is a little paperback book. I've actually given it away at baby showers and things for people. Excellent, excellent book that not only talks about introducing your dog to a child, but your child to a dog too, the other way around. And I would suggest that you read through that as well. But one mistake people make is they give lots of attention to the dogs when the baby's asleep. And then when the baby's awake, they isolate the dog so they can give their 100% attention to the baby. And what's the dog going to be thinking about this? Baby's around, I get nothing. Babies, when baby's away, I get lots of attention. Do just the opposite. Mm. When the baby's out and about with you, when you're nursing or whatever, that's the time to have your pockets filled with dog treats so the dogs are there going, wow, I love having this kid around because I get something special. And watch when the kid gets a little bit older, all that table food coming off the table, you may need to, watch your dog's waistline because we see dogs gaining weight right along with the baby as the baby's growing.
I know that's not good, but it's really cute.
It is. I know.
And Amanda was right on the case again. She looked it up. It's Childproofing Your Dog, A Complete Guide to Preparing Your Dog for the Children in Your Life.
Perfect.
By Brian Kilcommons, and it's Kilcommons.
Perfect.
So good luck with that and congratulations on your soon-to-be baby, Libby. And let's go to Sandy in Springstead. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. My dog was diagnosed with blastomycosis last summer, and he was only 4 months old at the time. And we've had him on medicine for 9 months now, and he's still testing positive, showing symptoms when he comes off of the medicine. And I'm just wondering if there's any new medicine out there.
Yeah, there was a resident at the veterinary school that was doing work on blastomycosis. Unfortunately, he's finished his residency and is gone. But it is a difficult, because it's a fungal organism, it can be a very difficult organism to get under control. And it takes long term. I would be looking at, does your veterinarian have them on, an oral antifungal drug? Usually we're using something like itraconazole, I'm not a, definitely not an internist or a specialist in this, but that would be, that's one that comes to my mind. But it can be expensive. You need to make sure that they're on the correct dose, and that there isn't a site of infection. Sometimes we'll see it kind of in the eye or something where it can continue to be a problem for the pet. And that's those, some of those spots can be very difficult to get that medication to get into it. So, you know, testing positive, well, the test that we use is a an antibody test. And so they are going to test positive probably for a prolonged period of time because it just indicates exposure. So that may be why your dog is continuing to test positive. But what I would suggest you do if your veterinarian is having concerns, calling the veterinary school and asking to speak with the internal medicine people, they would be able to give you the latest and greatest on, you know, testing and treatment for getting blastomycosis under control. It's unfortunate we live in a state that has it. It's been really some heavy pockets up in northern Wisconsin. And because dogs are right down there with their nose to the ground, they're more prone to picking it up.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks, Andy, and good luck with that. And actually, Lois posted on the Facebook page that she's worried her 13-year-old lab might have mycosis.
Yep.
Can't keep anything down, but has been able to drink water since last Wednesday. Lyme's disease was testing negative. Organ function's okay. Has also lost leg muscle control. She's asking what the treatment is and his chances, but does that sound like Blasto?
It doesn't sound like Blasto. Okay. Usually Blasto presents with either draining sores or like wounds that aren't healing and respiratory signs. Okay. And sometimes they may develop acute glaucoma or something with it as well. But often dogs will come in with severe respiratory signs. So it sounds more like this dog has more neurologic issues. Mm. So I'd be worried that it might be something else rather than Blasto.
Yeah, with the muscle control
right.
loss. That
yeah.
sounds neurological.
Right.
So Lois, I hope you're listening. The best thing to do would be to
get them in
and shift the focus
right.
to a different possible problem. You can join the conversation with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And as always, you can leave a question, comment, or a photo of your pet. We love to see those on the Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show, and Mealer is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mealer, and next is Carol in Crandon. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I wonder if you could give me some feedback. I have two cats. One is older, a neutered male, who has been in good health. And then last August or September, I got a Siamese Himalayan cat that was between 5 and 6 months old and was living with two other male cats, and the person used to breed
mm-hmm.
cats and also had the female Persian separated. And then after about 5 or 6 months, and both of my cats are under vet care, I noticed an increase in the Siamese Himalayan cat was doing a lot of rapid sneezing,
mm-hmm.
and kept increasing with some discharge that the cat was trying to wipe from one of his nostrils. And then shortly thereafter that, my older cat was not developing those symptoms, but had so much head congestion
yeah.
that he was not eating or drinking.
My
so
goodness.
I rushed them to the vet, and the vet said they probably had herpes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the younger one must have given it to the older one.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite common. And mm-hmm. they both had antibiotics injections and was put on some L-lysine,
uh-huh.
Some kind of an oral syringe that
yep.
I put in their food, or actually with the one cat who stopped eating, I had to put it into
yep.
the side of his mouth.
Yeah,
let's
know,
see what Dr. Sandy has
yeah,
to say.
Well, herpes is a very common infection in cats. It goes by the name rhinotracheitis, and it is included in the vaccine that we give to cats on a regular basis. But unfortunately for many cats, they may get exposed to it from their mother because moms are stressed, just like us. If you have, once you've had herpes, you never get rid of it. You get a little stressed and you may break out in a cold sore, canker sores, or worse. Any contact, you know, a human would then be at risk. Well, cats are similar to that. So you've got this kitty that's nursing these kittens. She's stressed. She's shedding herpes. And these little babies are getting exposed. And even when we vaccinate, the vaccine does not prevent them from getting the disease. It lessens the severity of the disease. And so what you're describing sounds very typical. You know, sometimes they, you know, may have gone in to get spayed or neutered and they got stressed and then they have a recurrence of it. The herpes itself will not respond to antibiotics. It's a virus. And so the reason why we treat some of these cats with antibiotics is if we're suspicious that there's a secondary bacterial infection. Similar to us is if we had a common cold, which is a virus, and then we end up with a sinus infection. An antibiotic is going to get rid of the cold, but it will help the secondary infection that occurs because of all the damage that's been done to our nasal passages. And so for cats, once they've had herpes, they're never going to get rid of it, and it may go away and be quiet for the rest of their life, or they may have intermittent recurrences of it, and sometimes it presents with respiratory signs, sometimes it presents with eye changes, with either corneal damage, red eyes, runny eyes, where they end up with, you know, pretty severe conjunctivitis, and you ride it out and they may get better. Lysine has been found to be one of those things that has been helpful not only for people but for pets as well. It's an amino acid that helps stop some of the viral replication that is going on in the cat's body. It's not going to cure the herpes, but it may decrease the severity and the length of time that they may be showing signs of having herpes. And so it's something you can either use in a gel form, in a powder. There's lots of different. In fact, many people will go out and use the human lysine tablets if they can have a pet that is easy to pill. And that would be a very inexpensive way of doing it. I had to laugh. One of the veterinary products that is on the market just has taken the word lysine and turned it backwards, and they call it Enacil. Okay, so they've just spelled it backwards, and that's lysine. And so some people will have their cat on it all the time. Others will just use it if they're suspicious that they may be starting to have a recurrence. They'll get them back on it again and use it for a few weeks and then stop it. So very safe to use. But, you know, if they've had a lot of damage done to those nasal passages, they may be more prone to, you know, recurrent nasal infections because they just don't have those, that good filtration mechanism anymore. And so some of these cats will have chronic rhinitis or nasal infections that lysine is not going to help. So
may I ask another question? Mm-hmm. I recently, in the last 2 or 3 weeks, from Foster Smith, which handles a lot of pet products, mm-hmm. I got some Zerolase, which is the powdered L-lysine,
mm-hmm.
and it said that one can give 2 rounded scoops daily,
uh-huh.
and each scoop has 500 milligrams. Now, I've been giving that to each cat twice a day. I give them a little canned food in the morning,
yeah.
and then I... about a third of a cup each during the day of a good quality dry food.
Lysine is usually based on weight. And so when, you know, it's based, you know, typically is the veterinary products are going to have, you know, give so much to a cat that's up to 5 pounds or, you know, over 5 pounds. Mm-hmm. So it's based on weight, but because it's a dietary supplement and an amino acid, it is very safe to use. 500 milligrams is a pretty high dose to be using twice a day for a cat. So I question that, but if that's what's been recommended, it's not going to hurt your cat. You just may be giving a little bit more than they need.
Do you suggest that I use 1 scoop per cat?
I would talk to your veterinarian. They would have your cat's weights on record and then be able to help you with figuring out whether that would be an appropriate dose for them.
Thanks for that call, Carol. And let's go to Bonnie and Tomahawk next. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. I have a cat who's 12 years old, and he's a completely indoor cat. He does not like to go outside, and he's terrified of the car. We are now retired, and we'd like to go up to our cabin up north and take him with us. We would be up there for 2-3 weeks, and he would be terribly lonely at home.
Yeah, and, you know, this is something...
What do I do?
Yeah.
How do I get him in the car?
Yeah, I would start before you ever are even thinking about getting him in the car with getting him trained to use get in the crate. So get a top loading crate, not one that loads from the front where you have to shove the cat into this hole, but have a top loading crate that opens up, or if you have one of those front loading ones, dismantle it so it's just the lower half, put a nice blanket in there, throw some cat treats in, have it be a fixture in your house, and have it become a wonderful, pleasant spot for your cat to go. And especially if you put it on cue, jumping into the crate and you use a clicker or a cue word like good kitty or whatever, they start learning that I jump in the crate. Guess what? Food appears. I love jumping in the crate. Eventually, then you start closing the lid while they're having a snack in there and getting them comfortable with being in the crate for a brief period of time. Maybe have sitting next to you while you're watching TV and you can throw bits of food through the grate of the crate and getting them so that they're happy being in there. So it's not associated with every time I'm in the crate, I get thrown in the car and taken to the vet. Then you can start with very short trips in the car. You may want to consider spraying the blanket in the crate that you're using with a product called Feel Away. It's a facial pheromone that makes cats feel more relaxed and calm. And that may help. Talking to your veterinarian about using an anti-anxiety drug, they tend to really make cats loopy. But if you've got a cat that is so stressed that they're clawing at the cage and meowing and urinating and defecating, well, one, you need to back up and get them more comfortable with the crate, obviously, but you may find that medical management may be helpful as well. And these would be prescription drugs, and there are pros and cons on the different ones that are out there for cats. And this would be something that your veterinarian could help you with to try to find the right one. Sometimes just even giving cats a little bit of an antihistamine like Benadryl will make them just a tinge sleepy. Some cats override that and makes them a little wiggy and it makes them worse. So before you get your cat loaded up for that long trip up north, have a few little trial rides around your neighborhood and see how your cat does.
Thanks for that call, Bonnie. And we are talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, Amanda Magnus, our on-air producer. Just want to let you know that tomorrow at 11, Larry is back from his WPR trip to England to look at the gorgeous gardens there. He'll be visiting with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven, and Scott's going to explain what the extremes of heat and dry conditions or flooding up north means for our wildlife, plus the hot off the presses report from the Wisconsin Deer Czar, which is set to be released today. But right now, we are talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. And Sandy, we have more people waiting to talk with you, so let's go to Debbie in Salem. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, I would like to talk to you about a product that was recommended to me by a trainer that I would use in conjunction with some behavior conditioning for a dog that shows aggression toward other dogs. It's called OptiBalance.
What's in it?
It's a flower, they say. It's based on flower petals.
Huh. Huh.
You can go online and see it, and it is used to treat stress and trauma, which is what we believe that this rescue dog has from another dog, or aggression. And if you talk to the people who produce this product, they say they have great results with it. Some use it for a week before behavior conditioning.
Okay.
Some use it right before. You could put it on a pizza and food.
It sounds
and
like
it's a,
yeah,
an inhibitor, a brain inhibitor.
Yeah.
Is this the aggression relief formula?
It's the stress and trauma relief.
Okay.
Perhaps the rescue dog had a trauma, with another dog.
Sure. Yeah.
And reacts aggressively to when other dogs approach him.
Yeah, it sounds like this is very similar to like the Bach flower remedies. There's been on the market for years for human use, and people do use them in dogs as well. There's one that's called Rescue Remedy. It's basically a distilled flower essence in a brandy base. I'm looking flower essence diffused. Yeah, okay, so they've got a number of flowers in there, and it's, in a glycerin type base. So we've got it pulled up here online. I have not had great success with it being, I mean, is it going to hurt your dog? No. Is it going to help? I don't know. Okay. The big problem we have with these over-the-counter products is, have they done any controlled studies, or is everything that they are reporting just testimonials? And how much of that is just a placebo effect? And so that's why you really need to have some good controlled studies to be able to see whether it works or not. When I fly, I see a lot of people in airports and things, you know, putting Rescue Remedy on their tongue and, you know, taking it in, and people swear that it works for their dogs. And I'm like, okay, if you're finding that it works, by all means, feel free to go ahead and use it. But I, you know, to be a standalone thing, to allow your dog to be able to interact with other dogs, unlikely to be effective. And I think it's good that you're working with a trainer that's willing to try things, but you also are going to need to do some behavior modification and desensitization. And you may even have to jump to using prescription medications from your veterinarian that are proven anti-anxiety drugs, things that are in the like tricyclic antidepressant line, like clomipramine, or sometimes we'll use serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the fluoxetine, like our Prozac that's on the market. There's one in for dogs that's called Reconcile. So those types of things sometimes are going to be much more helpful than what your trainer is suggesting. So, you know, again, feel free to use it. It's not going to hurt your dog, but may not help.
All right. Thanks for that call, Debbie. And let's go next to Nick in Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
Hi. I just had a quick question for you. I know nothing about the cat social structure, and I'm not much of a cat person, but my daughter talked me into getting a cat, and of course that cat follows me every place I go in the house now.
And I think the key is that you said you're not a cat person. Cats, they tend to gravitate to the person that is ignoring them, because when you look at cats, I mean, they're not like, you know, like your dog that's like coming up and going, hi, how are you? You know, and you know, you're going to play with me. Here's my ball. You know, cats tend to gravitate to the one that's just like, I'm just going to sit here and ignore you. So the fact that you are ignoring your cat, maybe not you're not ignoring it, but the fact that you maybe are just not the primary care provider, you're going to be a little more interesting for the cat. So, and that's why. I mean, people will say, well, you know, I'm sitting here, I'm allergic to cats, I don't want to have a cat near me. Who's the cat going to go to? The person that's allergic.
Pretty much nine out of 10 times.
Yes, yeah. Right.
So, Nick, I think what you need to do is insist that the cat play with you, and that'll probably drive the cat away forever.
Yeah.
So, actually, the cat beats up on the 75-pound black lab, so he's actually rubbing. I'm getting used to him. He's kind of cool now, actually.
Good.
Not as cool as my lab, but, you know.
Well, and I just want to point out that Nick said, my cat.
Yes.
So I think the cat has won you over more than you're admitting. Thanks for that call, Nick. And Linda in Green Bay is next. Hi, Linda.
Hi, I'm calling from Green Bay, and we have kind of a strange problem with our spayed female. She's like marking like she's in heat, and she had been spayed. She's marking and she's yowling. She goes down the basement, and we have other cats who are all fixed and everybody's fine. There's four other ones. They're all fine. But this one, her name is Tweety, and she is really loud and
active. Yeah. What I would be concerned about is there is sometimes we do see surgical problems, and there's a condition called ovarian remnant syndrome, which means when they've gone in to do, and typically what's done for spaying is it's a complete ovariohysterectomy, meaning ovaries and uterus are removed. And so, if there's, you know, you don't get all of that ovary out, or there's maybe a little what's called ectopic ovarian tissue, where a little piece of ovary has developed on its own, it may get missed. And then that will start to produce hormones and make your cat do what it's doing. So this would be something to go back to your veterinarian and say, she's showing signs like she's in heat, she's yowling, she's urine marking. Springtime, like now, and summer is the time that cats typically like to cycle. So you may see it coming and going, where she's acting like she's in heat for a couple of weeks, and then she's out of it for a couple of weeks, and then back in for a couple of weeks, because that's typically what cats will do. They cycle in and out until they get bred. And so, yeah, this would be something to go back to your veterinarian, and it may require exploratory surgery to go in and start looking for a piece of ovarian tissue.
And Sandy, is that, I mean, other than the behavior issues that it's creating, is that actually a health concern as well?
Well, it potentially can be. I mean, if they've left a little bit of the uterus in, you can get what's called a stump pyometra, because they're cycling, they start producing the glands of the little bit of uterus that's remaining can become active, and then that can become infected, and now you've got a cat that may be very sick. So there can be some health concerns with it as well. And then that ovary could potentially become cancerous or anything else down the road. But living with the cat in heat is not fun. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's wise to get this looked into.
Okay. Thanks for that call. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks, Linda. And we had a question from Patty in Green Bay, and I think it's the first time I've ever heard this question. Do long-haired cats have longer tongues than short-haired cats? My fluffy cat seems to have a longer tongue than my other two short-haired haired kitties, she wrote.
Interesting. That's something I don't think that's ever been identified. It's an interesting observation, but it may just be, you know, individual variation. I know that I have a tongue that's long enough I can touch my nose with it. but why? I have no idea. You know, it's like, but I'm the only one in my family that can do that. So I think it may just be genetic, but
I think she's wondering if to be able to groom.
Have they gone through natural selection, and long-haired cats have, you know, been selected to have longer tongues? Weird. I don't think so.
Okay.
But yeah.
Well, and just since
that would
you
be a good research project.
Since
though.
You shared that about being able to lick your tongue, when we had the folks from the DNR here with bats in tow to talk about white nose syndrome, but bats in general, we were told that bats have long enough tongues that they can lick their eyeballs.
Oh my goodness.
I'm not sure why they would want to, but apparently they're able to. And they're pretty much their whole faces, which is helpful when they're eating all that great food. Yeah. Well, we have lots more to talk about with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And you can leave a question, comment, or a photo of your favorite pet on the Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show. Mealer spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in today for Larry Mealer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, if you're like me, the animals that are part of your family are important to you, and you want to keep them happy and healthy. But with new information coming out all the time and lots of different opinions depending on where you look, it can be hard to know what we need to do as responsible pet owners. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in today for Larry Mealer. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're glad to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine here for the next half hour to share new information and timely advice. Whether you're a lifelong dog owner or can't imagine life without a cat or two in your home, Sandy's ready to answer your questions about pet health when you call us at 1-800-642-1234. And don't forget to check our Facebook page for updates, news, and photos. It's The Larry Mealer Show, and you can click like when you're there to get regular updates on upcoming show topics. You can also send a question or a comment by email at talk@wpr.org. We'll be right back with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk right after this look at the news. Just like with human health concerns, it can be stressful when a pet is ill. And with so much information out there, sometimes one item contradicting the next, it can be hard to know where to turn for good advice. Well, once a month, we have the chance to turn to Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Sandy, great as always to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mealer. Larry will be back tomorrow after his big adventure in England on the WPR Garden Tour. Sandy, we have quite a few people waiting to talk with you. So let's go right back to the phones and Lynn in Evansville. Hi, Lynn.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This has to do with heat and animals who are housed outdoors. They're sheltered, but nevertheless had to contend with heat, and it may reoccur. I know that basically they don't have the means to sweat as humans do, but they do mouth panting. My question is, mechanism of heat loss one of only evaporation, Dr. Sandy,
yes,
where they're losing water only, there's no electrolyte loss at the same time?
Yeah. They don't. Typically, we don't have to supplement any electrolytes like humans do. In fact, if you've got a pet that is dehydrated and you give them like a high salt solution, they can develop salt toxicity. So you have to be really careful about doing something like that. And so I'd you know, stick with plenty of fresh water, well-balanced diet, and avoid any, you know, starting to, you know, give them Gatorade or anything like that.
Tuna fish is not good because it's salty?
It's not. It shouldn't have that much salt in it. Why would you be giving them tuna? Is this for cats or?
Yeah. And they weren't, their normal food, they were off.
Okay.
So I thought they have access to water and ice water, but this was just increasing the amount of liquidy
stuff they were eating. And we know that cats that are fed canned food will sometimes not even drink water. They just don't need that much because they're getting all the liquid that they need in their food. So taking a little canned food and adding water to it and making it into more of a slurry may help improve water consumption as well.
I have one that's FIV positive, and he was off both his wet food. I would chill his food thinking that might help. So we got chilled baby chicken food. And that seemed to make it a little bit more appealing, but again, didn't seem to be sufficient given the heat we had.
But even cats being carnivores, the research on food preference has actually found that once food starts, you know, they like it at body temperature. I mean, they are predators and carnivores, so the body temperature seems to be the temperature that they prefer their food at. Once it starts to chill down to room temperature or it's refrigerated, the acceptance drops. It doesn't mean that a cat won't eat chilled down food, but when they've, you know, looked at acceptance rates, it tends to be less. So, you know, giving it to them chilled may actually decrease the palatability.
So especially if it's a cat that you're worried about getting enough nutrition.
And I really worry about a cat that's FIV positive that is outside, you know, is he going to be exposing other cats to this? Is he just so highly stressed?
Cat in his own space.
He does.
He has fans.
He's
wiped down. He's hand fed. I mean, there's no chance.
Wonderful. Great. Good. Because it is an infectious disease. But it may just be, you know, if he's like so highly stressed, they're more prone to picking up infections and so on if their immune system is impaired. So, you know, keeping him isolated, yes, definitely. It sounds like you're doing everything right.
Great. Thanks for that call in. And Joan in Madison is next. Hi, Joan.
Hi. Yes. I'm calling about an 11-year-old rat terrier. She's real energetic and real good health and everything, or she seems to be, but they found lumps on her breast.
Yes.
And they did a lung x-ray. It came back clear, clean. They couldn't find nothing. My question is, right now, she's never been spayed.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also want to remove the lumps. Plan of action are we looking at here? Should we go ahead and
have her spayed? Yeah. When we look at dogs with breast cancer, we know that it is highly linked to them cycling through their heat cycle. When a dog has been allowed to have a couple of heat cycles, it is basically the damage has already been done to the breast tissue. They've been hormonally primed, and the dog has about a 1 in 4 chance of developing breast cancer during its life. Now, about half of those breast lumps tend to be benign. The big problem with it is that you can't really get a good answer until you take that breast tissue, that lump out, and have it sent in for histopathology to be able to find out exactly what type of tumor it is. Because even if you did a needle biopsy, we sometimes will see what are called mixed tumors, where next to the malignant cells are some non-malignant cells. And so depending on where the needle gets put in, you may miss having it there. So I think your veterinarian's right on and saying, yes, let's get those lumps out of there, have them looked at by a pathologist so you can kind of know what to expect down the road. And then spaying is not a bad idea, although the damage has already been done. The risk of your dog being a 10-year-old dog that still has a uterus there of having a condition called a pyometra or a pus-filled uterus that can be a life-threatening situation is great. And so if they're going to be anesthetized, go ahead and get that uterus and ovaries out of there at the same time.
do you recommend both procedures being done at one time, or?
Well, the incision to remove the breast tissue is right in the area where the spay incision is going to be made. So, you know, you're dealing with a 10-year-old dog, even though age isn't a disease. If your veterinarian feels that they can get both procedures done in a timely manner and that they can get that incision to close well, should not be a problem.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks. Welcome.
And actually, Joan's question brings up a point that we wanted to talk about, Sandy. Spaying a female dog not only obviously reduces the number of unwanted puppies, but also keeps her healthier, too. Mm-hmm. And there are different options, and you actually kind of alluded to this earlier in response to another question. There's the ovariohysterectomy, where it's the ovaries and the uterus removed, mm-hmm. or just the ovaries being removed. What are the pluses and minuses of those?
Yeah, I mean, as a veterinarian, I was taught when you go in and spay a female dog, you need to remove everything, get the ovaries and the uterus out of there. And so, you know, that's been kind of the norm in the United States, and yet in Europe, when it's necessary to remove some, you know, the dog's ability to reproduce, they typically just do an ovariectomy, take ovaries out only and leave the uterus in. And so, you know, there's been a lot of research looking at this, and are we teaching our students the right procedure? Mm-hmm. Should we be doing, you know, always removing everything? And the kind of pros and cons of this, when you're just taking the ovaries out, it's a much smaller incision. So they're going to be able to heal faster. It's a little bit safer for the dog. And it, you know, pain control, it's equal. I mean, you're, mm-hmm. you're still, they're both going to be recovering the same. So there's really no difference that way. Less hemorrhage with just ovaries removal rather than doing the full spay. We know that for intra-abdominal hemorrhage, it can be as high as 20% of dogs that have been spayed may have some hemorrhage after surgery. So at least that's what the research is showing. I don't know, you know, mm-hmm. Of course, any spay I did was always perfect. Of no, of course. You know, I'm just kidding. But yeah. And so you run into trouble sometimes with when you are doing a spay to remove the uterus as well, leaving some ovarian tissue there. Because of the way the incision is made, you may not get a good view of the ovaries. When you're doing the incision more cranial to just take the ovaries out, you may get all of them out of there a little bit better. So again, just those are just some of the things too. I've had other, you know, students ask me, well, isn't there a risk of if you leave the uterus in there, of them developing a pyometra? Well, you need the ovaries and the uterus to be able to do that. And so only if you were to provide the dog with some type of outside source of progestins and a progesterone therapy, are they at risk of developing a pyometra. So, and uterine tumors are rare in dogs, and when we see them, they're usually benign. So, you know, I don't know if there's a right or wrong thing to do, but I'm thinking that down the road, this is going to be something that veterinarians may be switching to, is just removing the ovaries and not the whole works.
Good to know. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. Do you have some health concerns with your pet that you'd like to hear Dr. Sandy's opinion on? We'd love to have you join in. And next, we have Marcia in Barrington, Illinois. Hi, Marcia.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Dr. Sawchuk, mm-hmm. I have a question concerning topical pesticides for dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Our dog never had anything like that put on her, but following a physical, she's in good shape, and the doctor recommended, you know, using a topical pesticide to ward off fleas and ticks, mm-hmm. because we have another dog who's outside more, and I was worried about my inside dog, you know, getting something.
Mm-hmm.
But shortly after the pesticide was applied, she went downhill. She started to become very lethargic. She wasn't getting up in the morning anymore, and her back legs were really weak.
And what pesticide did you use?
I used Frontline Plus.
Okay, all right.
And it was for the right, you know, weight for the dog.
Good. And this is something you purchased from your veterinarian?
Actually, we got it from Amazon.
Okay. That is one of my big concerns, okay? I went on Amazon and was looking at, you know, what's available, and somebody wrote in to say that their Frontline that they received after they ordered it was two big tubes, you know, not the size they wanted, a syringe to be able to, an empty syringe to draw it up. And I'm thinking, this is secondary market stuff. When you are buying anything for to apply topically for your pet, it's consumer beware. The best place to go is either through your veterinarian, or if you're using an online veterinary pharmacy, look for that special little gold seal on their home page that says VIPS, Vet VIPS, V-I-P-P-S, and it's a veterinary internet verified pharmacy, meaning that you know you're going to be getting what's on the package. There are many, many products out there, including Frontline. And if you go on and just even look up on some stuff on the EPA site that are fraudulent products, you may not even be getting what's in the package. I would be really concerned that did you use that product, the right one? Did you contact Marielle and let them know what happened?
I went back to my regular vet.
Okay.
Because initially we took her to an emergency clinic.
Okay.
And they did all kinds of tests and they couldn't figure out what was wrong with her. So then it was Memorial Day weekend. We had to wait a day. Then I got her in the very next day to my regular vet. And she was very concerned and did all kinds of tests too. And then eventually she referred me to a different specialist who was an ophthalmologist, because by that time our dog's eyes had become so inflamed. And which she was diagnosed with uveitis, but they didn't know what was causing that uveitis.
Yeah.
So I eventually did go back to my regular vet, and I told her my hunch, which I also told the eye doctor, and he agreed. He said it could have been that application, because there was no other explanation for all of her symptoms. It wasn't just the uveitis.
Right.
She stopped eating. She stopped drinking. She was weak. She couldn't jump.
Mm-hmm.
She was sleeping all day long.
Yeah.
And it was bad.
You know, anytime you are using products on your dog, work with your veterinarian. Is there a 100% absolutely foolproof product? No. I mean, look at even for people, like there's certain soaps that we may react to or shampoos that we may react to. And that can happen with pets. And so when we are using pesticides on pets, first of all, you have to decide, do they really need to have it used? Is the risk of using a pesticide greater than the risk of picking up fleas or ticks and tick-borne diseases? I think that in a case like this, this would have been something that Marielle probably, if they had known about it, they would be very interested to be able to check the product to make sure it was the correct product. Rather than saying, well, it was the Frontline, I really question. I mean, I've been using Frontline for years and years and years. And I have to tell you, its side effects are extremely rare. Mm. And what you're describing is so extreme I really have to question whether it was Frontline or not. Mm. Was it just coincidence that your dog developed a systemic disease that resulted in uveitis, or, you know, was it the chemical that was applied? Good, good question. But, you know, to be, you know, putting up stuff online that, oh, Frontline's toxic, there's a possibility that it might be for your pet. And so I would be recommending to avoid that. But if you have some of that chemical left, get it off to Marielle. Right. Have it looked into to make sure that it that is the product that you used.
Right. Thanks for that call, Marcia. And we'll get to Ann and Madison in just a minute. But Sandy, I want to make sure we talk about the fact that July is Rabies Awareness Month. And why do indoor pets need to be vaccinated against rabies?
It's the law. Okay. I mean, actually, in Wisconsin, it's the law for dogs. It is not the law for cats. It's locally, our local ordinances require pets to be vaccinated. And the main reason why we do it is so that if your pet were to bite or scratch somebody, you have to show proof of rabies, that they are inoculated with rabies vaccine. If you can't, then you're looking at an expensive quarantine where they're out of your house, in a facility where they can be monitored for a 10-day period of time to make sure that they have not contracted rabies. It's a vaccine that is generally very safe, and you're taking your chances. I mean, at the vet school, we have some departments that will not even touch a pet unless they're current on the rabies, because the risk of someone being bit or scratched, and now the owner then is going to be responsible for having them quarantined. So, you know, making sure that they're up to date. We did have, I had a client, this was 2 or 3 years ago, cat strictly indoors, 12 years old, not vaccinated for rabies since it was a kitten, and they found a bat on the floor. Thank goodness they sent it in, and it was a rabid bat. And the family had to go through post-exposure prophylaxis, including the mother-in-law that was visiting. And the cat had to go through a very lengthy 6-month quarantine period during this time. So stranger things happen, even with indoor pets. So,
and is the rabies vaccine a 1-year vaccine or a 3-year vaccine?
When we're vaccinating, there are vaccines available that are 1-year and 3-year. For cats, there is a unique 1-year rabies vaccine that is very safe. It's called the PureVax rabies vaccine. It's not adjuvanted, meaning that it's not irritating when you give it to the cat, but it needs to be vaccinated. They need to be vaccinated annually because it has a 1-year label on it. We live in the Madison area. We have a 3-year rabies ordinance. And so there are 3-year vaccines available. But in reality, some of the 1-year killed vaccines that are similar to the 3-year vaccines, they're the same. Mm. There's no difference. It's just they're labeled to meet certain local ordinance requirements. So, but there are no 2-year vaccines out there. And yet I still see pets coming in and the veterinarian has put down that it's due in 2 years. There are no 2-year vaccines. There are 1-year and there are 3-year. So I'd go back to your veterinarian if they've been saying, hey, it's a 2-year vaccine, and say, what gives?
Yeah. Which one is it? One or three?
One or three. Yeah.
All right. Let's go to Ann in Madison. Hi, Ann.
Hi. My question is about prednisone for my little Cocker Spaniel for her itching.
Mm-hmm.
She started out on 60 milligrams, and then we worked down to we were just a half a tab every other day. And she was doing so well that I, of course, happily took her off of it and just put her on Zyrtec and fish oil.
Mm-hmm.
And now she's showing a lot of itching again, but...
The big problem with using prednisone is it's very helpful for short term to kind of put the fire out, but pets and pet owners get kind of hooked on using it because it is so effective at controlling the itch, but the long-term side effects are great. It can suppress the adrenal glands, thin the skin, predispose them to infections. It's dangerous to use long-term for allergy relief when there are other things that we could potentially use that are safer. This would be something I'd talk to your veterinarian if your dog is really plagued by, you know, allergies and is uncomfortable using cyclosporine. There's a one that's labeled for dog use. It goes by the brand name of Atopica, but it is used daily to sometimes every other day. And the dosage can change depending on how the dog is. If it's in the height of allergy season, they may have to be on a higher dose than during the times when allergies are low. But that's going to be much safer to use for your dog than prednisone is long term. So if I'm going to use prednisone, I maybe for 5 to 7 days just to put the fire out while everything else is kind of kicking in, mm-hmm. getting, and then I get them off of it. I rarely ever jump to using that, even to put the fire out. Often we'll be using cyclosporine rather than that.
All right. Thanks for that call, Ann. Mike in Elkhorn emailed, my curious coonhound was sprayed by a skunk at about midnight last night. I got some tips from the internet and had some success, but was wondering if Dr. Sandy could recommend a solution, home or commercial, that would get rid of the remaining smell.
Oh, it's, you know, one of the funniest pictures I ever saw was I had a friend who had a dog that had been skunked and just reeked middle of the night. Always happens at night. They didn't have any tomato juice or tomatoes, you know, like, so they used stewed tomatoes. And this poor dog is sitting in the bathtub covered with chunky tomatoes, and it's all over the bathtub.
Chunky tomatoes.
You know, they use stewed tomatoes to get, you know, cover the dog up.
Dear.
Well, I mean, is that going to work? Probably not very well. But there is, if you go online and look at homemade skunk relief, it's a product that you can't put in a bottle because it would explode. But it's baking soda, peroxide, and Dawn dish soap. I think they say Dawn. And it's just a small amount, and you use that, and that seems to be very, very effective. There are some commercially available things. There's one called Skunk Off, and I've had some success with the product that we use at the vet school called AOE, Animal Odor Eliminator. That's sometimes helps with that as well, but it's probably going to be there for months. Every time your dog gets wet, you're going to be reminded of your evening of trying to get the the skunk smell off your dog.
And we had an email from Helen. My Aussie hunts, kills, and eats small animals. She's a farm dog and can't be stopped. So what health concerns should we worry about?
Primarily intestinal parasites. And this would be a case where for heartworm preventative, I would be recommending one that's called Iverheart Max. It has a different dewormer in it that also gets tapeworms. So it gets the major parasites plus tapeworms, and you can have your dog on that monthly, and it'll clean that intestinal tract out.
And any other concerns about?
That's the big thing. I mean, toxoplasmosis, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. But typically, if you've got a dog with a good immune system, that would be something that they should be able to handle. But it's mainly intestinal parasites are the big thing.
And just in kind of the last minute, Nancy in Brighton emails, my dogs have bald, dry skin on their elbows. I was wondering if that was a result of laying on hardwood floors. Can I use moisturizer on their elbows?
You could. It's calluses, and it's very common for them to get that. And sometimes we will see calluses getting quite big and irritated. There's a product that are these things called dog legs. They're kind of elbow pads for dogs, custom made. And go to the website, dog legs. I think it's got two G's in it. Dog and then L-E-G-G. Okay, dog legs. And that may be something that your dog will be more comfortable with. But give them bedding to lay on, too.
But often calluses develop where you need some protection. So you don't necessarily want to eliminate
them. But if they get
them
really thick or, irritated, infected, then definitely get some padding on there.
Great. And I just wanted to point out that Amanda got the website up for the Parasite Council. I'm trying to remember the exact name of it there.
It's capcvet.org.
Yes. So we have that up. Well, Sandy, always a pleasure. And you answered a lot of really interesting and important questions today.
I know, a lot of different calls today.
So thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We'll see you again in a month. Sandy is here on the second Tuesday of every month. So we will look forward to having her back. And we look forward to having Larry back tomorrow. He'll be talking with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven about what's up with our Wisconsin wildlife. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network.